We're going to read from the book of Judges, chapter 2. This is the 31st year of your conferences. And you know what happens after the 30th year, don't you? That's when the new generation comes along. And this is the new generation. I've never been here before. And so I'm here bright-eyed and bushy-tailed to start off this new generation. My 26-year-old said to me on Tuesday evening, "Dad, I got some bad news for you." I said, "What's that, Phil?" He said, "Look," he said, "you probably haven't noticed, but you are now an old man." And I said, "Gee, thanks, mate. Why would you say that, particularly at this time?" He said, "Well," he said, "you've just joined the panel of speakers at the men's conference and they are all old." I thought about that, but then I thought about people like poor old Bruce Buckley. He's not old. Now, he's on the conference. Gee, he's having an early ageing. And there are others too. Marty from Watara, you wouldn't hardly say he was old, but maybe this is the impression that has grown up. So as a young man, I'm pleased to be here and share with you in the start of your new generation. We're talking about generations from the book of Judges. Did I say Joshua? I meant Judges. Judges chapter 2, and I think it's verse... Yeah, it's verse 9, I think, or thereabouts. I can read the big print, but can't read that small print. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each of his own inheritance. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua, and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things that the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance, at Timnath-Herah, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. After that, the whole generation had been gathered to their fathers. Another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what we have done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and served the Baals. They forsook the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods and the peoples around about them. The scripture goes on and tells us some of the bad things that happened. And then down to verse 18. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet that they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. And like their fathers, they quickly turned from the way in which their fathers had walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. And whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and served and saved them out of the hands of their enemies, as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. I don't propose to expound the scripture therein tonight, but just to say, as 30 years pass, and as one generation goes and a new one comes, you've got to have change. And sometimes change is not good. And the change that occurred here as the people of God possessed the land of God was not good. They had changed their environment. They had changed their way of life. They had changed their administrative structure. They had changed the way by which they were led. And they changed their God. They changed their theology. And they went down the creek. And then would come the man of God and he would lead the people under the hand of God. And for a short time, the leader of God would lead the people of God and again Israel would be the land of God. But this whole period through the book of Judges, you know it well, is an incredible period of ups and downs. And there were times when the children of Israel would leave the fertile valley and they would live in the hills, such as was the case in the time of Gideon. You see, the pressure would come, the people would fold, and the people would leave the land that God had given them, and they would really live a sustenance existence, never intended by God. Folk, we live in an age of incredible pressure. We live in an age of change. And I think over this weekend, all the speakers are going to help us come to that question: have we left the things of God? Now, this is opening night, and this is not purposed to be a theological dissertation. What it is a look at our world, a look at us, an understanding of what's happening to us. And the idea is that as we journey through this, we might see that it's okay to have a problem. You know, in the generation in which I grew up, in Christian Brethren circles, if you had a problem, you were not spiritual. And we didn't talk about our problems, lest we'd be banished to the back seat and the emblems passed us by. But things need to change. There is not one person here tonight, including the speaker, that doesn't have a problem. The difference between you and myself up here is that I have many problems and you probably don't have many problems. But we share problems. Why is that? Well, we're talking about the pressure that's on individuals. And it's this pressure that stresses marriages. And pressure comes when a force is out of balance with another force. Pressure comes from a differential in force. And unfortunately, this is what change does. As change comes down the pike, and as change hits us where we are in our situation, pressure must come. In many cases, the change that occurs in everyday life is faster than the human can psychologically, mentally, physically, and spiritually cope with. And much of the pressure we have in life comes from the rate of change that comes our way. Now, there are many ways people have suggested to handle this pressure. But I want to help you tonight understand what's happened over 30 years. What's happened over the time when Graham Scott first came to this conference as a young 20-year-old, and now comes tonight as a moderately old man. And there are others out there too that I put in that category, not just picking on Graham alone. We're going to realise that we live in an era of unheralded change. We're going to understand that problems will naturally exist as a result of change. It's okay to have a problem, but it's not okay to deal with a problem. When I was a young man, it wasn't okay to have a problem, so therefore you didn't have to deal with it. Today it's okay to have a problem, but you've got to deal with it. Quite a change. The seeking of help today is not an indication that I lack spirituality entirely. Or, look, I could be more spiritual. There's no doubt about that. Just ask the people that I live with. Ask the people that I serve with at Norwest Community Church. But the seeking of help is not an admission of failure. I believe the need to seek help is more a reflection of the times in which we live. And so it's pretty important that you grab onto that tonight and you share with me some of these huge changes. And then we're going to finish up with a spiritual exaltation that we don't drop in to the generation change that occurred in the book of Judges, that we ensure that we regain our first love for the Lord. So let's follow the pressure of the change over 30 years. What was marriage like in the 60s and the 70s? Now, I'm pretty qualified to speak on this because I was married in the early 60s. But just a little bit before that, my dad was the sole breadwinner in our home. My dad, as every young man of my age would testify, taught me indelibly about the Depression. And I didn't live in the Depression, but I think I could describe it pretty precisely. The impact on our fathers... Oh, is there anybody here that can remember the Depression?
Okay, I want the young men to go and talk to those guys who can remember the Depression. I think it's an essential part of education. Go and ask Graham what he recalls of the Depression. Oh, Jack here, of course, 65. You probably were around the Depression, weren't you, Jack? Yes. So go and ask these older guys about the Depression. And if you were able to keep your family together with a loaf of bread on the table, a fairly waterproof roof, and we only had one pair of shoes, even, and this is into the 40s, that we're allowed to wear on Sundays and Sundays only, you were doing pretty well. And do you know what? That gave Dad a tremendous sense of achievement. And Dad also was the liberator. People of my dad's generation would march down the street on Anzac Day and the nation would stop in adulation. Because what these guys did during the Second World War was remarkable. Worthy of respect. And so we are the seed. People of my age are the seed of men that had really accomplished, held a family together through the Depression, held a country together through the Second World War. And they were the fathers of big families. You know, when people ask me today how many kids you've got, I sort of say four, because if you've got four kids, they sort of think you're some sort of sex maniac or something. I didn't come from a particularly big family, but that was childbearing problems that my mother had. But, you know, my dad's generation, there were nine kids in my dad's family. He had nine siblings. And you see, the man was a person who put the bread on the table, kept the enemy at the door, and was the father of big families, a man of great respect. The woman, on the other hand, was pregnant, barefoot, and in the kitchen. Now, I've put that up that way because I also want to say this. Women were respected in the 40s and the 50s. My mother was a barmaid. You probably don't know this, but this Christian brother here comes from a Catholic family. And my mother used to pull beer in my grandfather's hotels in Adelaide. Go to Adelaide and you'll see Pierce's Hotels. That's all the hotels of my family. Well, on the mother's side anyway. And my mother would testify to the fact that in all the years she pulled beer, she never heard a man swear in the pub when she was there. She never heard a dirty joke. She never witnessed a brawl, although it happened quite often. The old Australian thing was rip the coat off out the back and have it on out the back. Women were respected. And my dad was 5'3", about 8.5 stone, and he would knock the head off Goliath if he said anything offensive about my mum. You see, women had a distinct role, but they were incredibly respected. You could even just see that in the way they dressed. You know, to go shopping, the women wear the hat, put on the gloves, a new pair of stockings, the shoes would be polished, and that was just to go to the grocery store down the end of the street. And so this was the 40s. It was there in the 50s, but it started to fade out at the end of the 60s. And the respect for womanhood started to lapse as we moved in to this later period, the late 60s and early 70s, of the so-called sexual liberation. And during this period, women became sex objects. And they didn't like it. And I believe it's this and other factors too, but this is a principal factor as to why women's liberation took off. Us men folk no longer treated the women the way that our fathers did. Now, maybe they didn't want that, but the behavioural change caused patterns in the way that women perceived themselves. Women felt used, and maybe this gave birth to the women's liberation age. Now, through the 60s and 70s, women were starting to become better educated. When I was at high school, there were a lot more fellows in the university entry year than girls. But today, that is not the case. So, 60s, 70s, we're starting to go through the age of sexual awareness. We're starting to come into the age of better education, as far as the women are concerned. And I don't necessarily mean better education, but I mean academic education is made available to the female on a greater basis. And through this education and some of the stuff that started to emerge, doubts started to emerge about male and female roles. And these doubts carried over into marriage. And it was starting to become not quite so fashionable to hide the fact that you had a marriage problem. It might be physical, spiritual, or mental. And then that solid institution of marriage that served the Western world, including Australia, well, started to show cracks in the mid-70s. Now, by this time, we had moved into and started to move into the post-Christian era. And there were two things that held marriage together around the mid part of this century into the 60s. And that was religion and commitment. And commitment really meant something. The wedding vow meant something in the 40s and the 50s and into the 60s. But then once the church had no longer a great influence, once society accepted that maybe the commitment to marriage wasn't lifelong, and once our society came into the post-Christ era, marriage started to crumble. Now, we've picked up a number of factors there that have brought pressure on marriage. But just highlighting the ones that I believe are the most significant, it's male-female role change, it's a downward influence as far as religion is concerned, and then commitment once the standard of the society started to abate. Sexual awareness, better education, the diminishing of church influence, and the progressive disenchantment with a non-perfect marriage placed marriages under incredible strain. So then we got to the era of let's change the law, lads. Now, Australian law was based on British law. And where did British law come from? A lot of it came from the church and the Bible. And the way that marriage law was enshrined in British law was consistent with what God says about marriage. The two shall become one. But then the trendies decided that marriage wasn't about two becoming one, because that was a little bit too religious. Marriage was really where one person came alongside another person and we whopped some glue on and we stuck them together. And if it was only a stick job, well, then it's reasonably easy then, or it should be reasonably easy to sort of pull the people apart. And so the law was changed. Society changed. The partner's firm belief in the marriage commitment changed. And that which held difficult marriages together was no longer in place. And so we come to the society that accepts the concept of the non-lasting relationships. Enters the 80s. And in the 80s, materialism reaches its peak. The better education that the woman's got enables married women to work to sustain materialism. And women, up until the early 80s, basically worked for two reasons. Reason number one was to buy the motor car
and they used to call it project working, where they would work to buy a holiday house or an extended overseas trip or a motor car or some big consumer item to get on the house. The other reason that women worked up until the early 80s was those that had the genuine interest in a vocation. And so people or women worked on a basis that the only reason for long-term commitment was it was a vocation. And in the 80s, the male position changed. People of my generation, unless they'd been to Vietnam, which was a disaster anyway, had really not much to talk about as far as their exploits at war were concerned. People of my age have suffered, yes, we remember the tight economies of the 40s. We can remember Menzies' credit squeeze of the 60s. We can remember the corporate fallouts of the 70s with people like Mainline and that going to the wall. We can remember the 80s and the recession there, and certainly we know about the 90s, but we don't know nothing about the trouble of the 30s. And in a way, we see ourselves as wimps compared to our fathers. And we now have this phase in Australia that's called passionless mateship. The men that stood together and fought the Second World War really put their lives on the line, trusting their mate. Now, we've withdrawn from that generally in our society. And we have our mates, but with as little passion and commitment as we can. Australians are individualists. And we've got this crazy mix where on the one hand we want to be seen as macho, and on the other hand we really are a generation of norms. And really, probably, the way that we want to prove our manhood is by the alcohol we can consume. And so we have got quite a changed society as far as us menfolk are concerned compared to our dads. Now for the woman, as we'll see in a moment, things have changed. She now must work. She's got to use her education. She's fighting a battle between her recognition of her worth at work and the value of being a homekeeper. And she's fighting for more time to have with a man because she's busy and he's busy. Towards the end of the 80s, the need for the two incomes became a necessity. You see, the value of the pay packet in 10 years had been fretted away as far as disposable income comes by interest rates and taxations to the point that the value of the disposable income in one pay packet reduced to one third over 10 years as to what it would have been at the start of that decade of years. And it's pretty impossible to sustain, or it was at the end of the 80s, things might be on the change again now, but certainly at the end of the 80s and into the 90s, it was impossible for young families to live on one wage. And that in itself has brought a tremendous societal change into our homes. The fact that the disposable income earned by one pay packet crashed. This has brought a phenomenon whereby in 1988 the number of mothers working with children under five then became the majority, and that number's gone up since that time. And so whereas my mother and my wife, from the time that they bore their children, would never work again, has ceased. And that is not a matter of greed, as some of us older folk would tend to accuse the younger generation of. It's a matter of necessity. Now there's other employment changes occurring. Male employment is going down. And over that 5-year period from 80 to 85, and carrying on since that time, male employment has gone down. Female employment has risen.
The percentage of women in the workforce has risen, where the number of males has gone down. The overall trend is the percentage of people working has gone down, and it has significantly gone down into the 90s. The face of the workforce is changing. When I was a lad, an apprentice electrician, the workers were many. The foreman and the supervisors were huge. In tertiary institutes like Sydney Tech, Institute of Technology in South Australia, the largest student body was that mid-management level, the supervisors and the foreman who went to formalise their training on top of their technical expertise. And then, of course, there's always been the head honcho, the guy who's hung around the top. The mid-status worker is being squeezed today out of the workforce. But there is also changes occurring at the senior management level. You are living in a generation where you can probably not recall, if you're an older person, so much senior management being retrenched out of business. And even the top of industry looks different today. It is no longer a clear point. What has happened is experience has given way to qualification. And you have to be exceedingly skilled and maintain your skills to stay at the top. Man, aren't things changing? Marriage has changed. The workforce has changed. And the population's changing. Now, this is a snap picture taken of the male population. At the base, as I indicated, we have there the number of newborn males. And as the graph goes up, men die. Like as you see at the top of the graph, there's not too many on the graph at 100 years of age. And there's a couple of interesting things about that graph that you need to note. What's that region there? You see, the darker bit indicates the growth in those numbers in 5 years. Why is that an area on the graph that indicates no growth? Them are the war years. Simply, the menfolk weren't at home to procreate, to have people of the age between 53 and 48. And that's that gap on the chart. Now, the big bulge coming on behind that is the age of the baby boomers. And as you can see from that, we have an incredible ageing population. And the same thing holds for the women. But you see, they sort of hang on at the top of the curve longer than us guys. They go 5 or 6 years longer than we do. Now, we are in an ageing society. A century ago, if a guy lived past 45, it was somewhat remarkable. And so last century, marriages were sort of getting to be a bit long, around 20 years. But you know, some people hang on today to 50, 60 years of marriage. And that's putting incredible pressure on marriage. And the amount of breakup that's occurring with people 30 and 40 years of marriage is not insignificant today. So during the 80s, society became more driven by materialism, ownership and status than the need for caring relationships. Dog began to eat dog. Corporate takeover after corporate takeover occurred. And the commercial mess left into the 90s gives testimony to the greed of our decade of indulgence. And as we've said here, women needed to work at the end of the 80s. We've covered most of this material, so we can skip through rather quickly. So we've seen changes in church influence, economy, employment, and population. Enters the 90s. We live longer, we work less, there is sex role confusion, and there's marriage pressure. This year we'll celebrate 110,000 marriages and uncelebrate 50,000. Many of us still hold traditional church views. Some hold ideas that can only be described as Victorian and can't be sustained by Scripture. And differing views from one generation to the next is not a new thing. But we live in an age where the generation that follows mine cannot understand traditional values. They have been bombarded by the feminist movement and many other things. And many good church folk today are bewildered by the breakdown of marriage values due to divorce amongst people close to them. The natural reaction is to contend for the conventional solution. And so our young people are confused. But if we were very, very fair and admitted honestly to ourselves, we also are confused. Little wonder that we have marriage problems in the church today. Oops, I didn't mean to say that. We haven't got marriage problems, have we? We're isolated from the problems, aren't we? Because we, you know, we really do have a handle on marriage and what the Bible says. But if we're honest, there's not too many of us here tonight that haven't been touched by the divorce of a loved one. And so when the young men, now in their 50s, came here 31 years ago, divorce was something you clearly understood. It wasn't on. It's still not on as far as God is concerned, but it is happening amongst us. Our fathers held to marriage because the Bible said we had to. Let's do that, but we need to go one step further today. We need to do it because the love of God constrains us to do it. Now this weekend is designed to assist us in moving along better paths towards solving marital problems. The first step is to recognise and be prepared to deal with our problems. You know, the facts supporting a rethink in our churches are huge. One in three marriages in our communities fail. Commitment is no longer enough to keep marriages together. We need to keep marriages together based on commitment and by seeing better marriages. Marriages that you just want to be committed to occurring in our churches. Let's all learn to love again as a first answer to handle the pressures that we have seen as we've gone quickly through these slides. I wonder whether the Lord can say to us, as Revelation 2:4 says, "Yet I hold this against you, you have forsaken your first love." You know, things were pretty heady for the children of Israel. Things changed incredibly quickly from being slaves 40 years on, they are now landowners. They've lost their first love. We have been the generation of incredible change. And I believe most of it has not been good. People get sick of me saying this, but it's got to be said. I will hand to my sons a poorer Australia
than the one that I took from my father. Fellows, we are the generation in Australia that blew it. We are the generation in Australia where the decline in church attendance has been significantly bad. We are the generation that has overseen the split up in marriages. I wonder whether God can say to us, as he had to say to the children of Israel of old in Scripture, they knew not the God of their fathers. I wonder whether he says of my church, you have lost your first love. Well, we're not old. We've got time to do something about it. And this is the weekend of challenge. Are we going to go into our corner and cry because things have got tough and the changes have been huge? Or are we going to do something about the problems that are amongst us? If nothing more comes out of this weekend, I'd just love every one of us to be able to accept a couple of phrases that the computer is now going to flash at us. First of all, it's okay to have marriage problems. Secondly, but it's not God honouring to not deal with them. It's okay to have marriage problems, but it's not okay before God to not deal with them. Your marriage, my marriage, follows one of three paths. Either it's getting better, or alternatively, there's subtle conflict. You know, that's where we sort of believe, well, we're holding it. You know, we're on sort of a horizontal path. There's no such thing in marriage, as we'll see tomorrow, if you come to marriage lasting workshop. There's no such thing as the horizontal line. The horizontal line goes down. Or there is overt conflict in your marriage. And I guess it starts with a self-examination. Is my marriage getting better? Is it holding? Or is it getting worse? Let's take the pressure off ourselves caused by these last 30 years by learning to love again. You know, I think it's delightful to look at the selection of subjects that we have before us. And it would be great if everybody here could be open-minded and say, I am really going to set my mind this weekend to learn how to love better. We can't change the world. We can't change the environment. But God can change me. And that's the challenge of this weekend. Am I going to be one of God's agents of change? Am I going to change? Now, I've finished, well, almost, and I've been asked to set your assignment. You know, apparently you're people that can stay up to all hours and... But we're not looking for an all-out assignment. I was supposed to finish at 9:45, and I've pretty well kept the bargain. And up until about 10 o'clock, we're going to spin the chairs and get into huddles of two or three, and we're going to discuss something I'm going to put your way in a moment. But a true story. You probably know that I'm not a Sydney person. I've told you the Adelaide story. Basically, well, half my life I lived in Adelaide, the rest of it pretty well all around the world. But when I got married, marriage counselling was something that just wasn't available. And one elder said to me, look, Trevor, I've got some advice to you. This will make marriage work. When you get married and you go on your honeymoon, on your first night, when you take your trousers off, put them on the bed and say to your wife, "Now, who's going to wear these, honey?" I wished I'd had the intellect then to have laughed as you guys did. And he said, if you can gain agreement that you're head of the home, that will guide you through all of your marriage. I thought, well, okay, here's the order, I'll try it. That was until I got the second set of advice from another elder in our church. And his advice was, Trevor, your marriage will not last because you're not dominant enough. And I thought, I've been in this church ever since I was in Sunday school at 11 years of age, and he doesn't know what a stroppy bird I can be. And I thought about this set of advice. On the one hand, one elder's telling me to be dominant, and the other elder's telling me I can't do it. I was a bit confused. They were both wrong. It sort of lasted 30-odd years, and it's not going too bad now. But, hey, think back. Think about the problems you've got. Think about the help that perhaps you would have loved 20 years ago. Well, we are here as the generation of change. And what I want you to do is sort of think, and I don't want you to particularly share personal stuff like I've shared, because nobody will run home here and tell my wife, I feel sure of that. But just think. And ask yourself this. Are we doing enough to help the marriages in our churches today?